I'm Afshin Ratansi and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE. Tomorrow, South Africa, a nation that dismantled something of Anglo-American-backed apartheid, takes the helm of the G20, the first African country to do so. But what does the G20 even signify in a world where US-backed escalations towards Russia edge us closer to nuclear Armageddon and apartheid Israel openly commits genocide in Gaza, shielded by Washington's complicity? If Ukraine, as it was, may no longer exist, will Israel exist at all in 50 years' time? After a UK-US-EU armed genocide that has left a scar across all humanity. Israel's existence is questioned in a new book, The Killing of Gaza, Reports on a Catastrophe. The author, longtime columnist at Israeli newspaper Haaretz, is Gideon Levy. He joins me again now from Tel Aviv. Gideon, thanks so much for coming on. What an amazing book. It should be on any national curriculum so far. It is the definitive book of the genocide, arguably. Before we get to Israel's existence, tell me about what M, as you call him in your Haaretz columns, is telling you about Gaza when he gets through to you on the phone in the past few days, perhaps this week even.
Thank you for having me, first of all. It's always a pleasure to be here. M is an old friend of mine who took me around in Gaza for years and years. And we really got very, very attached one to the other. And I lost him in the war. The matter of fact is that I was quite afraid to call him because I was afraid to hear that he was killed. But here and there, I tried to look for him and I couldn't find him. And after a year, all of a sudden, I saw his name on my cellular. He couldn't call me. He could just send this message. And I called him immediately back. And then I realized that he survived. He's 62 after a stroke, not healthy. He told me about his daily life in the last year. I didn't speak with him almost nothing, not about politics, not about anything else but the survival. How do you survive in this horrible reality of Gaza day after day? What do you eat? What do you drink? What serves you as a toilet? I mean, the most basic question. How do you cover yourself in those cold nights now without electricity, without anything? How do you cook? I mean, really things that show what a catastrophe it is, what a human catastrophe is taking place when we both talk now here.
Yeah, there's something of Primo Levi in your book, arguably. You mention in your book the word Gaza means in Hebrew, how they refer to Gaza. Just explain that.
Yeah, Gaza in Hebrew, we say it Aza, and Aza is the first part of the word Azazel, which means hell.
Hell.
And hell, right. Go to hell, Lech la'Azazel. And sure enough, Israel turned Gaza into a hell. It started to do so in 1948 with transferring there thousands and tens of thousands of refugees who could never go back. And ever since 48, Israel again and again is turning Gaza into a hell. But this time it is really unprecedented because whatever Israel did to Gaza is uncomparable to what it did this time. And I guess that both of us and none of our viewers, unless he's in Gaza, can imagine himself. What does it mean to live in the last 14 months, 15 months, 13 months in Gaza under the Israeli attack, under the Israeli barbarian attack, I would say, wandering from one place to the other, having no shelter, no income, no safe place to spend the night, watching all those atrocities, seeing the starvation, seeing the destruction. I mean, how can people survive this? For me, it's a big, big question mark.
You write in the book of how more and more Palestinian teenagers in the occupied West Bank are writing wills these days in the wake of events in Gaza. Tell me about these wills that you write of. Do not place me in a freezer, he wrote. Bury me immediately.
Yeah, one of them who unfortunately died. Look, when a young guy is leaving home in the West Bank, not in Gaza, and it's incomparable what they go through and what they go through. But even in the West Bank, which is having quite a routine life now, a routine life under occupation, when he leaves home in the morning, he never knows, will he get back? Will he be arrested? Will he be shot? Will he be injured? Will he be humiliated? Checkpoints are everywhere. Soldiers are everywhere. They come to your home at night with dogs. They come to your home in daytime. Life is a small hell also in the West Bank. And it brought many young people, part of them also from the resistance, to write last wills, to write testimony, because they feel that their life is worth nothing and it might end in any given moment.
And of course, you refer in the book, it's sort of split in two, before October 7th, after, and you talk of the so-called leftists. The phrase leftist, you don't put in inverted commas, but it's a word that I think arguably is abused all around the world these days. You say the first to lose their minds were, as usual, the leftists after the atrocities of October 7th. Tell me about the so-called leftists of Israel.
So we must characterize them in a more precise way. Those are the Zionist leftists. Those are those who established the state of Israel and established also the occupation, established the kibbutzim, but also established the settlements. They are those who want to feel good with themselves. They are liberals. They consider themselves liberals. They are fighting against Netanyahu. They are demonstrating every Saturday. They are very devoted. They are very proud about their moral attention and moral consciousness. And by the end of the day, they turn their back to the occupation, to the apartheid, to the atrocities in this war. And those, in my view, are the worst, because hypocrisy is screaming to heaven. You know, you have the right-wingers, the racists, who say, listen, the Palestinians have no rights in this place. They will never have any rights of this place. We are the chosen people. We deserve everything. They deserve nothing. And we should either transfer them or kill them. At least what you see is what you get. And what you get is what you see. When it comes to the so-called liberal Israeli, average liberal Israeli, they are much nicer. They don't speak like this. They really seem so liberal when they look in their own mirror. They are so self-contented with their moral profile. They are against so many things, and they even are in favor of a Palestinian state one day, not now, obviously, but one far day, they will even be ready for this. But meanwhile, by feeling so good about themselves, by protesting against the right thing, they never cross the border, they never cross the line in asking basic questions. Is there really a difference between you and the right wingers when it comes to the occupation, to the settlements, to the apartheid? What did you do for fighting the occupation or the apartheid or the settlement? And what is your share in establishing all those phenomena, passively or actively? Those questions are not raised there. And that's a typical Israeli left Zionist. They are called also central left. And they are the only alternative to the right wingers. And when this is the alternative, so it's really quite questionable which one is better, because both are so disappointing, so depressing, so much not leaving room for any hope.
And of course, their strategy arguably is to personify the genocide with Netanyahu. There's a film called The BB Files, clever Zionist film arguably, about the corruption and the trial of, upcoming trial, no doubt, of Netanyahu. They're already preparing the way for blaming the whole genocide, everything, on Netanyahu and his wife and perhaps a couple of cabinet ministers, not Israeli society as a whole? Is that what they're already prepared to do? Not blaming it on Israeli society and, of course, Britain, the United States and the European Union supplying the weapons?
Much before the war, they were protesting very bitterly only on one issue, against Netanyahu. Only not Netanyahu. As if we just get rid of this demon, Israel will turn into the beautiful, moral, just place that it used to be all those years before Netanyahu. There is no bigger lie than this. Netanyahu intensified all kind of phenomena. Personally, he's corrupted. Personally, he does things that others wouldn't do. But when it comes to the main issues, to the main questions, to the core of the problem, there is very little difference between them and Netanyahu. And by fighting against Netanyahu and putting everything only against him, it's a very comfortable zone for them. Because by this, you know, you just blame Netanyahu and all the rest is fine. And you concentrate, you focus only in fighting against him. And then you feel so good about yourself because the problem is Netanyahu, nothing but him. Just let us get rid of him and everything will be so beautiful. And that's another lie that we are lying ourselves or telling ourselves in a very hypocritical way, because they should know that the problems did not start with Netanyahu and will not end after Netanyahu will be replaced. And he should be replaced, no doubt about it. But to put everything on him is really a comfort zone.
And before he goes to jail, is his only option now, and his enablers, Blinken, Sullivan, Biden, Harris, the only option before January for him to go to war with Iran, regardless of losing against Lebanese resistance this week. They have to go to war with Iran, even though Iran tried to connect what was happening with the Lebanon situation. Is there going to be a war before January?
There's a good chance. Netanyahu hinted about it, but I'm not sure it's possible. I'm sure it's not clever. It might end up in a catastrophical way. But nobody knows if this is going to happen. For years, we were told that Israel cannot do it by itself. It needs the assistance of the United States. And the question is if the United States will go for it. And I don't have an answer for this.
Gideon Levy, I'll stop you there. More from the Haaretz columnist and author of The Killing of Gaza, reports on a catastrophe after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the Haaretz columnist and author of The Killing of Gaza, reports on a catastrophe, Gideon Levy. Gideon, you were talking about what the United States' response would be, perhaps, to any Netanyahu war on Iran, enabled by the EU, UK and US. Do you think it's possible that all 2 million, if they're not killed by 20th January, Trump has promised to lift all military supply restrictions, that Trump is going to go for it even harder? He's been criticising Netanyahu, or he's been criticising Holocaust Harris and Genocide Joe for not supplying enough lethal weaponry to wipe out the Palestinians.
Look, one administration after the other, we got disappointed. We had so much hopes when Barack Obama came to power. We were sure that he will really change the policy of the United States toward Israel. And even with him, not only it didn't happen, he just doubled and tripled the aid to Israel. And I don't have a problem with the aid to Israel. I have a problem with the aid which is totally unconditioned. I mean, Israel is not following one advice of the United States, is not following one request of the United States. And still it gets everything with no limits almost. And this brings me to many question marks. And therefore, I don't see Donald Trump really changing this tradition of supporting Israel more than any other country in the world, with a big question mark: is really Israel the most needed place in the world, who deserves so much money from the American taxpayer? But that's the American business, not my business. My business is that this aid could have been a tool to influence Israel, to help Israel fight its own crimes and mistakes. And the United States is not doing it. And I have no answer. Why? I mean, the Americans speak about certain things that they asked from Israel. None of them is implemented, and still